We're doing Parshat Yitro. In our Parsha, the Jewish people will receive the Ten Commandments. The whole concept of receiving Torah from heaven is something that's beyond what we can perceive. What does that mean? Hashem tells us, here's how I want you to behave. Hashem is infinite, we are finite, and Hashem talks to us. It's a game changer for all of humanity. Our Parsha is unique in all of Torah. All of the people of Israel will stand at the feet of Mount Sinai and receive the Torah. Our parsha is replete with concepts that are critical to our understanding of Torah and to our understanding of how Hashem runs the world and what Hashem wants from us, what our mission is over here. We will quickly try to run through our parsha. Let's begin. Yitro comes to Moshe. Why was Yitro away from Moshe? Well, Moshe tells him, I have to go take the people out of Israel. God has told me to go. And when Moshe leaves him, so the classical medrash that everyone knows is that Moshe comes with Tzipora and his two kids. He meets Aaron. And Aaron asks, who are these guys? Moshe says, oh, this is my wife and these are my kids. And Aaron says, we regret we brought our families here to begin with. You're bringing more people we should regret. So Moshe says, oh, it's a bad idea to bring them here. Fine. He says, Tzipora, go back to your dad with the kids. Tzipora goes back to her dad after we leave Mitzrayim. So then Yisro comes with Tzipora and the kids, and he cannot enter Moshe. There are clouds surrounding the camp of Israel. They cannot go in. So he wraps around an arrow, a letter, I am Yisro, and he shoots it, and it lands in the camp, and they bring the letter to Moshe. So Moshe goes out to greet Yisro and bring him in. Our parsha records the names that Moshe gave his children. Gerishom says, I was a sojourner in a foreign land. Everyone else had their family around them. They were at least together as a Jewish people in Egypt. I was alone. And so Moshe's, so to speak, apologizing for having given in to Yisro to adulterate one of his children's education. Those who listened to the WhatsApp last night, I quoted the Medrash there, that Yisro insisted that one child be educated in polytheism? What? And then learn about monotheism. First be introduced to everything else and then come to monotheism. And Moshe didn't feel like he had a choice and he gave in, and our sages fault Moshe for that. And then he had another son, Eliezer, where he recognizes that Hashem is the one helping him. And so Moshe goes out to greet Yisro and his children. We are uncertain. We have Machlokas and Medrash. When does this story take place? One opinion says, the way it's written, Yisro came and then the Torah was given, etc. The other Medrash says, no, this didn't happen now. The Torah records it now. But really, Moshe's children were not present when the Torah was given. Yisro only came later. The Medrash says, Yisro had no right to receive the Torah because Yisro didn't suffer what the Jews suffered. He was living the good life out in Midian. The Jews worked hard. The Jews left Egypt. This one was missing an eye. This one was missing a leg. This one was missing an arm. Everyone was maimed. They had earned the right to receive the Torah. Yisro didn't earn the right. This is a very important concept. Very often when we have challenges and hardships in life, so we wonder, why do I have to go through this? We have to know that when we face challenges, good is going to come from it. And there is good in the world that cannot come if you don't overcome hardships. Anyone you see in this world that you value, that you feel has accomplishments, you should know they didn't get there without a lot of hardships. And when we face the hardships, it's important to remind ourselves that from hardships comes greatness. We have to deal. We shouldn't bend backwards and fall. We have to stand up to the challenge and realize that good will come from it. And so our sages take it so far, the Medrash says, it cannot be that Yisro was there at receiving the Torah. He didn't earn it. He didn't work hard. He didn't lose an eye or a leg. How could he be there with the Jews? The Jews lost an eye or a leg. So of course they could receive Torah. They had suffered so much for being the Jews even before Torah. Yisro, why should he get it? He should just waltz in and get what everyone else gets. Yeah. I guess the Levites also suffered. And if not, they earned the right not to suffer. But you see, how do we know that the Jews suffered more in the last 83 years of working? Because Amram names his daughter Miriam over the bitterness. Sounds like they were embittered too. Maybe. Could be. Could be, I don't know. You're right, it wasn't 83. Whether it was 86 or 82 or 81, I don't know. It's in Seder Olam Rab. Yes, Gabriel, good evening. That's a good question, I don't know. It's a good question. I don't know. I don't know if they were there either. Okay, so you're answering the opinion that says they were there. So Moshe goes out to greet his father-in-law. Throughout Tanakh you will see great people honoring their father-in-law. In Shulchan Aruch, in the laws of honoring parents, it says you should honor your father-in-law. The Jerusalem Talmud derives it from a man whose father-in-law wasn't so good to him. We all know everyone has complaints about their father-in-law. He promised me a car, and he only got me a Mercedes. I was expecting a Rolls Royce. You know, he promised me a house, and he forgot to build me a pool in the back. Well, everyone has complaints about their father-in-law, right? This man also had reason to complain about his father-in-law. You see, his father-in-law sent soldiers to kill him, and he had to climb out the window and escape. And then his father-in-law spent a year or more pursuing him and trying to kill him. And then finally, he comes up to his father-in-law after his father-in-law had gone into a cave and he could have killed him, right? And then he comes after him and he says, "V'avi re'ei gam re'ei." Father, look. Look over here. I have the corner of your coat. Who's he calling Avi, his father? He's calling King Saul, his father. David HaMelech was being pursued by his own father-in-law who wanted him dead. And then when Saul went into the cave, so David went over to King Saul's cloak or talis and cut off the corner. And then when he comes after King Saul, he comes out of the cave, he says, "Avi, my father, re'ei gam re'ei, look over here. Look how I could have hurt you and I didn't." So the Jerusalem Talmud says, you see, how does David call his father-in-law? Abba, he calls him Avi. So from there we have what many people do, and it's recommended to do, that people call their father-in-law Abba, their mother-in-law Ima. Toda rabba. Just a second, are we celebrating something? That's what I thought. Okay, mazal tov. Before we eat and drink, we should know what we're celebrating. Baruch Ata Adonai Eloheinu Melech Haolam, Shehakol Nehiyeh B'Tzvah. Correct.
It's a soldier.
It's up to him and them. And then the question here is also if it's offensive to his own parents. So Moshe goes out to his father-in-law, he honors him, and he bows and he kisses him, and Moshe brings him back. Our sages say, Moshe and Aaron went. When Moshe and Aaron went, so Aaron's children, the Kohanim, saw them going, they went. The elders saw this procession, so they went too. And then the Medrash uses the famous term, who would see such a procession and not go and follow them? Meaning anyone who saw Moshe, Aaron, the sons, the elders going, anyone who saw that said, hey, I'm going too. And so Yisro standing outside the camp and he gets this great honor. Everyone comes out towards him. So Moshe tells him all the wonderful things Hashem did for Am Yisrael. The pasuk says, "Vayichad Yitro." The word "Vayichad" could come. What's the root of the word "Vayichad"? Yachad. Okay. What's the root of the word "Vayichad"? Chad. So one opinion says he took a chad, vayichad. Yisrael took a blade and he slit off his foreskin on the spot. Vayichad Yitro. Yitro said, I want to be one with you guys. Give me a knife. And he circumcised himself.
Real quick.
Vayichad. What is the root of the word vayichad? Give me another word root. What else do you think could be the root of the word vayichad? Echad, very good. Vayichad Yitro. The second opinion says he accepted monotheism. Vayichad. Yitro recognized there's only one. So, or Vayichad, like you said, he joined the Jewish people. There's a fourth interpretation, which is the Targum. The word happiness in Aramaic is Chad. Chadi is to be happy. So, Vayichad Yitro. Yitro was very happy over all the good Hashem did to Am Yisrael. And then there's a fifth interpretation in the Medrash that says he got goosebumps. He starts hearing about how all his compadres, his friends from Egypt, drowned, and he felt very bad. Guys in the Machon once went to watch a soccer game together, and there was one guy here from who did Giyur from a country that was playing against Israel. And every time that country got a goal, he'd go, yeah! And all the guys would look at him like, we thought you were a ger. Like, how come you're rooting for that country? So Chazal say, that's legitimate. A person is going to feel an affinity for their home country, and you have to be careful. Don't put them down in front of him. It's normal. It's natural. And on the contrary, our sages say, when Moshe told Yisro all the things Hashem did to punish the Egyptians, Vayichad Yitro. Yitro felt like he himself was getting cut. All those people from Egypt were his people at the end of the day. So Yitro joins in celebration, he unifies with the Jewish people, but we are taught to be careful. And the Aruch HaTzadikim writes that one has to be careful even when they're going to talk about something, not about a specific person or a specific nation. If you say something that someone interprets, you're talking about them. So that's not right. Do we have anyone here from, I don't know, I got Ecuador? Yes, okay. No, pick a country. Mars. Okay, we don't have anyone here from Mars. Okay, so if you were to say, you know, there are some Martians that are really annoying. So the guy sitting here from Mars right away thinks you're talking about him. Right? So the Aruch HaTzadikim says, if you talk about a certain trait or a certain attribute or a certain nationality, the person sitting in the room assumes you're talking about them. If you say people with mustaches, so everyone with a mustache thinks you're talking about them. You know, people over a certain age tend to be. I wasn't talking about him. I had this friend who grew his beard in this and this way. So even though you're not talking about the guy sitting in the room, but if he grows his beard that way, so he starts thinking, everyone's looking at me, everyone's thinking about me. Aruch HaTzadikim says it's not only a ger, it's also other things we speak about that could make a person self-conscious, and everyone feels like he's talking about me at that moment. So we have a rule for generations after a person does giyur, we should be sensitive not to speak badly about his nationality. Do we have anyone here from Germany? We do. Okay. So I that's something that we have to bear in mind. There's we used to have four or five guys from Germany in the class. No, I'm very serious. Yeah, I'll tell you a secret. I'm also from Germany.
If I was not born there, every time somebody speaks about Germany, somehow I think maybe speak about me.
Right?
I was not born there. My mother's not
tell you a secret.
Not German.
Right. And my wife's my mother's family are Holocaust survivors. My father's family ran away from Germany. And still, when people talk about Germans, I have this feeling, are they talking about me? Right? Funny, right? Yeah? Isn't that strange? But my grandparents spoke German at home. I'm saying I nicht.
Take that as a yes.
9. Yes.
In a general way about Germans themselves, if you would say some specific things, or you're talking with each other about, you give your opinion. And if you're not speaking about Germans in general,
So exactly that. That's what he's saying. That's what Dorcha Tzadikim is saying. That if you're speaking in the presence of someone who's from that nationality or who has that issue, even though you're not talking about him.
Not say anything negative about where they're from.
Okay, still. I didn't follow. What did you just say?
So that you cannot say anything negative about where they're from.
Right, not in their presence. Right?
Because they might think that it's
100%, yeah.
Every German Jew has to feel bad during this week of the Holocaust Memorial Day or whatever.
I didn't say that. I'm just saying there's a sensitivity that we're being taught over here.
We're talking about goyim most of the time now. So.
What?
We're talking about goyim then. So that's like the Jews from there.
Well, Chazal spoke about a ger.
Yeah, okay.
And the Orchas Tzadikim takes it to something that's not only a nationality. He says it's other issues. Part of my teeth are false teeth. Okay, I assume no one else here has that. Okay, I want to take an example that's only relevant to me and not someone else. So if someone were to say, you know, there are people who have false teeth and they consistently are playing with those teeth. So even though I'm not, but there, you know, if a person were to say, you know, I'm not always comfortable shaking the hands of someone with false teeth because I always wonder if they just pulled out their teeth and put them back in, right? So they're not thinking about me. They're not, because they, until now, you guys didn't know I have some false teeth, right? But that doesn't mean a person doesn't start feeling self-conscious. That's what Dorcha Tzadikim is talking about. You didn't talk about that person at all. You gave an example that really is not that person. But that person will right away think, he's talking about me. I'm saying, Chazal said it about a ger. The Orchas Tzadikim says it about other things, not only a ger.
Well, I understand German and Yiddish. I know they're talking about something with black shoes.
They were talking about?
Black shoes.
Black shirt, okay.
What in the beginning? I said,
what is it? What's your name?
Yeah. No, so he's telling you, okay? He said they were talking about a black suit, but when he heard them initially say the word Schwarz, which in Yiddish means black or German, so his first thought was they were talking about him.
I know who I know.
So it makes total sense.
Yeah.
Right, that would always bothered me as a kid, right? And did it have? No, it didn't. It wasn't a sharp, it was an arrow with a rubber point.
You're talking about contained area.
You're 100% right. You're 100% right. It says you're not allowed to shoot an arrow. You're 100% right.
Yeah.
I am happy you asked that. You're 100% right. Okay. So the truth is that the Medrash explains that shooting an arrow is a metaphor. He found someone who had come out of the clouds because they were defiled or something, and waited till they were going back in, and they gave it to them. The shooting of an arrow is a metaphor. You're right. To shoot an arrow into a camp is a dangerous thing, and it's wrong. It's, you know, you're 100% right. When I was a kid, this medrash always bothered me. Yeah. So, yes. That's a good question. Why the medrash talks in metaphors? That's a good question. It's a good question. Okay. Huh? Maybe. Let's leave it for now because we got 25 minutes left for such an important parasha. Let's move on. So Yitro recognizes Hashem's hand because Hashem does midah keneged midah. Why is that so unique? So Nachmanides in his letter explains that we always look for Hashem in our life, but you never know. Maybe because I blinked, the lights went out. Maybe the lights went out because I didn't daven shachris with enough kavanah. Maybe the lights went out because there's an electric problem in the building. Maybe a lot of things. So we look for signs, and yet you have no idea when you're inventing them and when not. But when it's midah keneged midah, our sages say Hashem does things that are similar, an eye for an eye, a trait for a trait. So then a person can see Hashem's hand in things. That's why Yitro was impressed. Because in paganism, they also said this happened because of that. They were always looking for signs. But when he saw ki vadavar asher zadu aleihem, he was part of that discussion. How should we turn down the Jews? How should we destroy them? How should we get rid of them? So they came up with this plot. We'll throw them into the Nile. That's how we'll get rid of the Jews. And then Yisrael ran away. He said, I'm not partaking in this, right? So that was Yisrael's last conversation there in Egypt. Now he comes back and he hears, how did the Egyptians get destroyed? In the Yam Suf. So Yisrael says, oh, they wanted to destroy the Jews by water. Hashem destroyed them by water. Ki vadavar asher zadu aleihem. He said, okay, this is clearly the hand of Hashem. This is not someone inventing the sign. So Yisrael offers sacrifices, and they all sit down and they have this festive meal. Moshe's judging the people, and it takes a very long time, and his father-in-law says, this isn't going to work. Why are you sitting here alone? He says, people come to ask me questions. We learned yesterday they'd ask the prophet not only about Torah, but also about their mundane things and how to serve Hashem. Remember, we had a question last week. In ancient times, did people go for therapists? So we discussed how the prophet would also be someone's therapist. They would give them guidance how to improve and how to grow in the service of Hashem. So Moshe says, they come to me with all these questions. And Yisrael says, this isn't going to work. You're going to wear away. It's going to wear you down. It's too big for you to do alone. You have to ask Hashem, and if Hashem approves, you will appoint leaders, judges, who will guide the people. So this is a rule in life. If you do something, you are very limited. If you can delegate, you are almost limitless. The more you can delegate, the more you can accomplish. Rule number two, when you delegate, things will not work out the way you envision it. They will be different. Sometimes better, sometimes worse. Definitely not what you planned. That doesn't mean it's bad. The mere fact that you delegated already makes it good. Remember that. If you delegate it, it's good because it allows you to accomplish more. Provided that you delegate responsibly and you clarify to the person what's expected of them, after that, recognize how positive delegation is. What?
Very difficult to delegate something. Because normally everybody wants to be sure it's going to be good.
You have to know to do it.
You have to have ability to delegate.
You have to acquire that ability to delegate. You have to, and I'm trying to give you the tools. When you recognize that by delegating you accomplish more, not less, and different isn't necessarily less good, then you delegate. Some of you came this past Matzei Shabbos to the Halacha class by Rav Binyamin Fishman in Kochav Yaakov. So those of you who attended thoroughly enjoyed. Why? Because he gave a very good class on the laws of kashrut. Wait a second, I'm the rabbi of the shul, shouldn't I be giving that class? It's the laws of kashrut, it's people's kitchens. So the answer is, yeah, theoretically I should be giving that class. But by delegating it, he could give it when I can't. He could cover many details that I would never get to. He gives a style that's not my style. This past Shabbat, I thought I wouldn't be able to be there for my Hilchot Shabbat class. So I asked him to give it. So he came in, and then in the end I was there. So I had asked him to do it, so I sat in the audience and I listened. So he gave a topic which I had taught in a Hebrew class. He gave it in English an hour earlier. And he taught it completely different from how I had taught it. So initially it annoyed me very much. I did build the whole shiur very differently. By the end of shiur, he had accomplished everything I had accomplished, and his way of presenting it might have resonated with people better than mine. You know, I'm biased. I present it the way I think it through. But his presentation, which was completely different, might have been much better than mine. What's for sure is it was different, which is already good.
But the yad is the same yad.
By the end of the shiur, we had said the same thing. By the time we had concluded, he had reached the same things. I thought it was better to build it differently. Maybe I'm wrong. Who knows? It doesn't matter. Different is good. It's not easy, but it's good. And when you delegate, then you have the capacity to do more. It has to be a goal to delegate. It's not a weakness. And if you find people who are better than you, that's when you start accomplishing well. Your goal should be to have people who are better than you working with you or for you. Then you can accomplish more. When people want to run a one-man show where they're the top, they're the best, then they run into problems. When I came to shul, one of the first things I did was give a lot of honor to a big Talmud Chacham who was in the shul. People used to call him by his first name. And he's a huge Talmud Chacham. So I would sometimes stop in the middle of a speech. They'd ask me a question, and I wasn't sure what the answer is. And I'd turn to him and ask him in the middle of the speech. I'd say, I'm not sure. Rabbi, what do you say? So the whole crowd saw, hey, he's asking him. Right, I'm asking him. That guy's a big Talmud Chacham. They should be respecting him more. In life, when we can help people grow all around us, everyone wins. The people win, your people win, everyone wins. You accomplish more. So Yisrael tells Moshe, delegate. And in life, the earlier you learn to delegate, the more you'll be able to accomplish. Now, you get burnt by delegating. We once had a person who was very ill, and they needed to go to the hospital. They had to have their bandages changed. They needed a special bandage, and the hospital didn't provide the bandage. So they had to go to the pharmacy and buy the bandage and go to the hospital to get the bandage changed. Fine. So we had a volunteer. I asked the volunteer, here's the type of bandage I need you to get. We have 45 minutes to get that bandage. Here's the money. I need two. And here's the exact description of the bandage. If you have questions, call me. Here's my cell number. Can you be back within 45 minutes? Yes. Okay, the guy comes back a half hour later. He bought one bandage. Now, I look at the bandage. He got the right one. I said, where's the other bandage? He says, oh, I forgot I was supposed to buy two. Did that volunteer help me at all? No. Now I have to go to the pharmacy. He said, but I really got to run. I'm sorry. Here's the bandage. Bye. Okay, so he didn't accomplish 50% of what he was sent for. From my end, he accomplished zero. Now I'm left with 15 minutes to get the other bandage. Now, if I'm going to the pharmacy, he didn't help me with anything. What difference does it make if I go to buy one or I go to buy two? By the time I have to go, he hasn't helped me at all. So maybe I shouldn't have delegated. Wrong. That's life. You will bite the bullets when you delegate, but there will be plenty of times when things work out well enough and sometimes even better, and there's no other way. There is no other way. If you don't delegate, you can't accomplish. Until this year, I used to, at the end of class, spend 15 to 20 minutes bringing the books down and coming back up and getting the T's down and coming back up and cleaning up here at the end of class. And I didn't want anyone else there. Why should I bother anyone? Right? I'd spend, it would take me now. I'm taking a bus home. I only get home an hour after class ends. So that meant I got home. I'd miss the next bus. I'd only get to the 10:30, 10:45 bus. This year I said, hey guys, why don't you help me take this stuff down? In 5 minutes we take everything down. 5 minutes instead of 15 minutes. I get a bus earlier, right? By delegating. So there are times that a tea is forgotten there. There are times that I come down and someone took someone's bag from there that's not the tea and I have to come back and put it back up. So what? But when you delegate, you accomplish more. It's a tool in life. We're moving on. No more questions. We got 15 minutes and a lot to cover. So Moshe Rabbeinu makes a mistake. When he appoints the judges, he says, when you have a hard question, come to me. He shouldn't have worded it that way. Even Moshe, who was so humble, made a mistake in this. It says, Yisrael went back home to convert his families to come back to Israel. And that's one opinion in the Medrash, that he wasn't around when the Torah was given. We come to the desert of Sinai, and here it says Vayichan Sham Yisrael in the singular tense, Vayichan, he camped there, Israel. Our sages say, every time we camped and left camp, there'd be fighting. That's my tent, that's my space, shift over there. One of our weaknesses as a Jewish people is that we litigate. We fight. We have a hard time being united. We have to know that unity is a goal, it's not only a means. And it's worth giving up on a lot to try and attain unity. It means giving up, yeah, forgoing things, right? That's how we attain unity. When we were united, we were able to receive the Torah. And in our history, when we unite, that's when we succeed. They camp opposite the mountain. And Moshe goes up. And Hashem tells him, go tell the Beit Yaakov. Who is Beit Yaakov? The women. And speak to the Jewish men. The Midrash says, if you want to succeed in something, get the women on your side. If they're on your side, you'll succeed with the men. There was once a very wealthy philanthropist where I lived. When the stock market crashed 50 years ago, money was worth more back then, he was on the front page of the New York Times that he lost $500 million. That was 60 years ago. That's like, I don't know how many billions today. So he was a very wealthy man. And I once went to ask him to donate to a certain organization, and he got very excited. And at the end of the conversation, his wife was at the other end of the room. He said, you got me, but you didn't get my wife. I said, what do you mean? He said, you got to sell her on the idea. I said, what do you mean? He said, go talk to her, explain to her, get her excited over it. So I left. I don't believe in talking to women, you know, I'm going to make her my friend. He said, you got to make her like you and what you sell. I'm not going to work on making a woman like me. I didn't think that was right. But the concept, he said, was right. The Pasuk says, Kotomal Levet Yaakov. You want to accomplish Moshe and get the Jewish people to accept the Torah? Talk to their wives first. I used to learn by Rav Moshe Halberstam Zatzal of the Eda Charedis. Very, very nice, kind, warm person. But with me, he was tough. There were times I'd ask him a question and he'd say, go and be well. I asked the question, he'd kick me out of his room. He'd say, go and be well. He said, but I told you be well, but get out. He'd kick me out of his office. When I'd ask him questions that he thought he shouldn't spend his time answering, he'd be tough as nails. But sometimes I'd come with a question with my wife. Suddenly you saw a different person. The sweetest person on earth. Everything he said was gentle and sweet and nice. That's the concept, Kotomar Levet Yaakov. You talk to a woman, you have to know how to talk gently, nicely, and sweetly. That's a rule for marriage as well. Men sometimes forget this. And Hashem tells Moshe, the Jewish people will accept the Torah, but first speak sweetly and gently to the women. Then go to the men and be tough as nails with them. Men need you to be tough with them. V'tageid livnei Yisrael. You've seen how I've taken you out of Egypt and brought you here, and now you have a choice. You keep the Torah, you will be my chosen nation. You will be a nation of leaders, and the Jewish people accept the Torah, right? They say, we want to do whatever Hashem says. Then the Midrash says, a pasuk later is going to say, we camped at the foot of the mountain. So our sages say, Hashem lifted the mountain over our head and said, if you want to accept the Torah, good, and if not, you're dying right there. So the Midrash asks the Midrash Tanchuma, why did Hashem need to threaten us if we already said we're prepared to do it? So one answer, which it doesn't say in the Midrash, is that we had to know that we made a good choice to agree to the Torah, but it's not like it was up to us to say no. Meaning sometimes you ask a person and he says, yeah, okay, I'll do it. And it's important to clarify, it's not like you have another choice. You're going to do it, you have to do it. And that was the message of holding the mountain over our head. But the Midrash Tanchuma gives another answer. The Midrash Tanchuma says, when it comes to the written Torah, it's fun to learn Tanakh. We enjoy learning Torah, the written Torah. It's enjoyable. You read, you understand, you move on. You read some more, you understand, you move on. Then you come to learn Talmud, and boy, is that tough. It's like walking in the nighttime. You're not sure where you're going. You're not sure what you're seeing. You learn through Talmud. You're not sure where you're headed. You work hard. You're not sure you got it right. It's frustrating. It's a lot of hard work. So when it came to the written Torah, the Jewish people said, Nah, seven Ishma, we're prepared. Whatever you say, God, we're ready to listen. Then they heard there's going to be an oral Torah. So the Jewish people didn't want to accept it. For the oral Torah, says the Midrash Tanchuma, Hashem held up the mountain and said, whether you like it or not, you're accepting it. Only in the days of Mordechai and Esther did they accept the oral Torah willingly. So the Maharal explains, the nature of people is that they're happy to learn Torah. Every Jew feels connected to Torah. Every Jew wants to feel connected to Hashem. However, the oral Torah, that's something you learn from a rabbi, you learn from a teacher. No one wants to connect to Hashem through a teacher. Every Jew wants to learn Torah and interpret it themselves and explain it themselves. There's a natural feeling that's mine, I'm connected. I don't want the rabbi telling me how I'm supposed to understand this verse. There's a natural inclination to repel, to say I don't want the rabbinic tradition. And that's why Hashem had to hold the mountain over their heads. We're moving forward, we're up to Chamishi. Hashem tells Moshe, I'm going to come and talk to you, and I want the nation to hear you, because when the nation hears you, so then the nation will understand that prophecy is true. They themselves will be witnesses to that, because they will have heard prophecy as well. The nation is supposed to separate from their wives for 3 days. From here we learn the concept that after a person has been intimate for 3 days, that seed can impregnate the woman. Modern science has backed that. So the concept is that after a woman has a man's seed in her for the next 3 days, if it spills out, after a couple is intimate. So the majority of the seed comes out the next time she stands up, but some remains inside, and that can come out during the course of the next 3 days, and after that it can't impregnate. It's considered like nothing, but for 3 days it's considered like a real seed, and therefore if it comes out, it causes her to be defiled, just like when a man has his seed come out of him, so he becomes defiled. So Hashem says, I want the women there, I want the women pure. Let the women and men separate for 3 days before giving the Torah, so that the women can all make it to receiving the Torah. Everyone has to stay away from the mountain. And Moshe tells the people, they all clean themselves, they go to mikveh, the wives clean themselves, and on the third day, it's early morning, everyone's sleeping. Moshe has to come and call the people. That's why on Shavuos night we stay awake, because the Jewish people overslept the morning of receiving the Torah. Moshe had to go wake them. So we show that we're so happy to receive the Torah, we're not even going to sleep. We spend the whole night awake learning Torah.
And then fall asleep in the morning.
Thank you, right.
So, and then don't pray. Then I'm fast asleep anyway.
I don't know. If you nap well the day before, maximum you put your head down for an hour during the night. Okay, so there are clouds, and there's smoke, and there's fire, and the mountain is trembling, and a shofar blasts, and Hashem descends with his angels on Mount Sinai. And Mount Sinai was low among the mountains. Our sages say, we learn from here, Hashem likes that which is humble. So Moshe is on the foot of the mountain with the people, and Hashem begins the Ten Commandments. The Ten Commandments came out in two ways. In 1 second, all Ten Commandments were said. And then each one was said separately. And after they heard Anochi, I am Hashem, your God. So our tradition is every one of the commandments they heard, they dropped dead. And then the angels resurrected them and they heard another one. And then they said to Moshe, we can't handle this. We're going to die. So they heard the first commandment. The first commandment is in the first person. Anochi, I am Hashem, your God. Every Jew has to learn and understand and reach a point where they connect to the concept that Hashem is our God. That's a mitzvah. Anochi Hashem Elokecha. We say Shema, we're supposed to understand that Hashem is our God, He is one. Hashem says, I am Hashem, your God, who took you out of Egypt. Because although Hashem created the world, we weren't there to see that. Hashem says, the exodus from Egypt is something you experience. So that's how you know me. Now I can tell you also that I'm the one who created the world. Next commandment, they also heard from Hashem. So it's also in the first person. Hashem says, you cannot believe in any other force but me. So those are the two first commandments, right? Two. We're not allowed to make a figure. We're not allowed to make a figure. So we're not allowed to draw a sun, a moon, stars. You're not allowed to make a drawing of any of these things.
What about when your child comes home and draws a picture of the playground and the sign?
Thursday night. We're not allowed to swear in Hashem's name in vain. Number one, when a person swears in Hashem's name, what he's saying is, believe me by the honor of Hashem. So that's very severe. What does it mean to swear in vain? If a person swears, he says he swears by Hashem that this is a table. So that's a pointless vow. He's using Hashem's name in vain. If a person says he swears by Hashem's name, this is not a table. That's also a pointless vow. He's saying nonsense. So that's called Shavuot Shav, a pointless vow. we are commanded to remember the day of Shabbos. We fulfill this commandment when we make Kiddush and Avdalah. Before Kiddush, I often ask the people around the table, what mitzvah are we about to perform? Because when we do a biblical mitzvah, we're supposed to make note that we're doing a biblical mitzvah. It's mitzvah tzichot kavana. So the biblical mitzvah of Kiddush is what it says, Zachor et Yom HaShabbat l'kadsho. Make mention, remember, connote the day of Shabbos to sanctify it. On the seventh day, we're not allowed to do any work. Our children, even minors, we are commanded in the Torah to ensure that our children don't do work on Shabbos. Our animals, we are commanded by the Torah. We are not allowed to put anything on an animal and then guide it and lead it. V'gerecha, we have a commandment that if there are people who keep the seven Noahide laws in Israel, according to Rav Kook, that might be all the Arabs of Israel. That's something that Rav Kook wrote about.
Except for murder.
So then I wouldn't be allowed to use them as a Shabbos guy. It's a good question what we're doing in hotels today. The Torah says, I want you to rest on the seventh day and make it a special day because Hashem rested on the seventh day. I didn't say that. I said it's a good question. We have a mitzvah to honor our parents. What does it mean to honor? Honor means to service. That means if your parent needs help putting on their jacket, if your parent needs someone to do the shopping for them, that's honor. Honor doesn't mean what people call today honor. Kabed kibud horim means to service them. The Torah says, lo tirtzach, don't murder. Short and sweet. Lo tinaf, niuf is adultery with a married woman. Lo tignov, we're not allowed to kidnap. Lo tanev reacha eid shaker, a person is prohibited from giving false testimony. Lo tachmod, do not covet. Do not covet means I shouldn't desire what someone else owns, their house, their spouse, their servants, their donkey, or today their car. So the commandment of do not covet is a commandment about controlling our emotions, our thoughts. And it's a very empowering commandment. It means we have control. Very often today people think, but that's what I want, but that's what I feel like, but that's what I don't feel like. Torah says, lo tachmod. You have a choice. You decide what you focus on. You decide what you're thinking on. A person decides what they're fantasizing about. Torah says, don't covet it. So we're up to Shvi. Says, the people came to Moshe and said, we need to hear from you. We're scared. We are going to die. It says every time a commandment came out, so they would jump back 12 miles. And then the angels would come and help them come back. So they couldn't handle it. Moshe says, no, this is important. When you hear the commandments directly, it makes you into greater people. From now on, no one will be able to challenge the veracity of the Torah. You are witnesses. You saw it yourself. From this point onward, even if someone walks in and says, God told me, whatever, you'll say, wait, I know the Torah is true, and I don't know if you're telling the truth, so Torah wins. And that's why this was such an important stance for the Jewish people. Moshe is summoned to speak to Hashem privately now. The pasuk describes it as Moshe nigash el ha'arafel asher shama Elokim. Moshe approached the mist, the fog, where Hashem was. Wait a second. The pasuk describes that where Hashem is, there's happiness, there's light. Why is it described as a fog or a mist? So Rav Nachman of Breslov has a piece on this. We have to know that approaching Hashem involves approaching something which is foggy and cloudy. It's only later that you get clarity. When you approach initially, there are many questions, and that's part of approaching, that's part of growing. It begins with questions. Hashem tells Moshe, you yourself are witness that I spoke to you from heaven, and you may not make with me figurines of gold or silver. You are going to make gold kruvim. People shouldn't think that I could do that on my own. When you make an altar, make it out of earth, and on that you will bring your sacrifices to me. And if you make an altar from stone, do not use a blade on it, because an altar extends life, the blade shortens life. And finally, when you make a ramp going up to the Mizbeach, it should be a ramp and not steps. And the idea is, number one, one should not reveal their private parts on it. Number two, this is a concept that when we ascend towards heaven, it should be a ramp, slowly and gradually. If a person tries to do it too quickly, then suddenly there are things within themselves which are an embarrassment that they haven't fixed, they haven't built up, and taking steps that are too big, too fast, causes that embarrassment as they go up in their ascent towards Hashem. So with that, we have concluded a quick version of our parsha, and we'll meet again, Be'ezrat Hashem, Thursday night.